Broadcasting live from atop the Rocky Mountains, the crossroads of the West. You are listening to the Liberty Roundtable Radio Talk Show.
All right, happy to have you along, my fellow Americans. Sam Bushman, Kirk Cosby, live on your radio. This is the broadcast for February the 12th in the year of our Lord, 2020. Our goal always to protect life, liberty, and property, and to promote God, family, and country in the traditions of our founding fathers. We've got a special two-hour interview going on right now with the incredible author, John Uller. And we're talking about his book that came out in 2016, The Swamp Fox, How Francis Marion Saved the American Revolution. It's an admiring biography of Francis Marion, 1732 to 1795, a military hero of the American Revolution. And I submit to you that the real character of Francis Marion and the real man is more incredible than even the Rambo type depictions on TV and everything else. I mean, you study this guy and you go, wow. And this guy was somebody. This guy was an amazing person. And a very small frame, 5'2 to 5'4 in height, very lightweight, not very big, kind of like a horse jockey guy, but yet very tough. He was tough as nails, wasn't he, John?
Yes. He slept with his men out in the rain and in the elements, and in the summer it was, you know, awful down there in South Carolina with the swamps and the malaria and everything. He endured all that alongside his men. So at an age of, you know, roughly 50, which, you know, people didn't live that long back then. You 50 years old, you were an old man, basically, at that time. So it just shows you how devoted he was to the cause he was believed in.
Now, what was he, 63 when he died about?
Yes.
Okay, so he didn't even really live that long when you think about it. 63 is not that old. You and I are about dead in that case, right?
You know, he was born the same year as George Washington, 1732, and died in 1795, and I think George Washington died in 1799. So they were pretty much, you know, roughly contemporaries, lived about the same age.
All right. Now, I want to talk about his character more. Again, to me, that's the big takeaway from the book and the separating fact from fiction. To a great degree, it was his character. It was who he was. Like I said at the end of the last hour, he was a religious person in many, many ways, but yet he didn't really wear it on his sleeve. He didn't run around and preach religion to everybody, but his character was he had the moral high ground, even in the middle of a very desperate circumstance war, didn't he?
Yes. One thing, he was not a drinker. I think he may have had wine once in a while, but an interesting little anecdote. When the British were besieging Charleston in 1780, Marion, being an officer at that time in the Continental Army, was invited to a drinking party downtown Charleston, and that the custom at the time, where the host was to lock the doors so that people couldn't leave until, you know, the wee hours in the morning after all the drinking had finished. And Marion, not being much of a drinker himself, decided he was going to jump out the window to make his escape. And he actually broke or sprained his ankle. And so he went around limping for the next couple months, even while he was hiding in the bushes and near the swamps, being hidden by friends and relatives after everyone else in Charleston had basically given up. So it was a little bit of a quirk of history. Now his men, you know, it was they liked their rum and the like. It wasn't very available down there, so he understood that he had to ration out that stuff to his men to keep them, you know, happy and content. So he was not he was not puritanical about it.
But he did warn his troops many times when they would go into certain circumstances, hey, you know what, get rid of the liquor, don't imbibe, don't go off and get drunk and do things that we're going to regret. Let's make sure that we're doing what we're there to do, was kind of his point. And he, even though they did drink, his men did drink, certainly, they did have respect for the point he was making, and they did, in many ways, support him in that, didn't they?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there might have been a couple times when they got a little out of control, but he he kept them in check as much as it was humanly possible.
Yeah. My whole point is lesser men, though, that wouldn't have stood on that moral point might have had a lot of things go wrong because of the alcohol and because of the plundering. Other men fell to that, whereas Marion didn't. Even though he couldn't create strict compliance, his influence and the respect for the man, I would submit, made the difference.
I think that's exactly right.
All right. What, as you studied Francis Marion, because, you know what, we grew up with a lot of this fiction. And I don't mean to down the fiction and stuff like that. I'm grateful to keep his name and his historical relevance alive. But what shocked you the most, or what, as you went on your quest for the preparation of this book and the studying and the, you know, all the research, and that's kind of the key to the exercise, what did you discover that you didn't know or that shocked you the most, or that you went, you know what, I'm pleasantly surprised? Give me kind of the landscape there, will you?
Oh, a couple things. I would say one of the geographical facts that struck me is just how vast the area that he traveled with his men were. You think of South Carolina as kind of a small state, but it's really the number of miles between engagements, and they would, you know, ride their horses 5-6 hours a day just to go fight at one little skirmish and then turn around, rest for a little bit, and ride back the other direction for another little skirmish. I mean, it was just the physical impediments and obstacles to him that he had to deal with, both the weather and the sickness and all of that, would have really, it's just incredible that he, you know, stayed the course through that.
So let's broaden that discussion a little bit. The big difference was the distances that you had to deal with made the South a whole different reality than the North, and it took those horses to get it done to a great degree. Not only were there a lot of miles that you're talking about to cover, because it's way bigger than you think it is, but there were also just all kind of things in your way, swamps and rivers and muddy bogs, and I don't even know how to describe it. My point is, it wasn't just like easy going miles. It was far apart, and it was very, very difficult terrain, and it was the uniqueness of these people on horses that understood it and had lived it and had ridden it and had understood it, and that even made that all possible, right?
Yeah, it was very, there were no, outside of Charleston, there were no big cities like there were in the North, Philadelphia, New York, Boston.
And no real good roads either.
No. Bridges were often out, so to cross the river, you either had to get in a flatboat, or sometimes, if it was fordable, you would just go across on your horse. Now, Marion also, he couldn't swim, so he used his horse to enable him to cross the river from time to time. So, you know, adding insult to injury, he couldn't swim in an area that had lots of lakes.
And again, most men would have panicked at that. He dealt with that, too. He just ignored it, I guess, right?
Yeah, now there is this legend that he, as a young man, when he went to sea, that they were, driven by either a whale or a hurricane or something, and the boat was overturned, and they were adrift on the ocean for a few days until they were rescued. So having faced that down and survived that, maybe the rest was, you know, a lot easier to take. Now, that legend is a little squirrely in its details, but something happened at sea that he survived, which maybe made him a little more steely going.
And
forward.
Is the reason for so much fiction about him and stuff like that, is it primarily because there's not a lot of information about the guy, or is it because they just like to embellish? I think it's that there's really not a ton of good sources about the details, right?
Yeah, it's both, I would say. You know, he did not write a lot. I mean, he wrote, you know, short military orders, but he didn't, you know, there's not a lot of, like, personal letters from him that show his character. You have to kind of infer his character from what he did and what other people said about him. So there's kind of a dearth of documentary evidence. There are some letters from him to Green and Horatio Gates, who was predecessor to Green, which sort of reveal his strategic thinking, his military strategy, but not a lot of course, there were no emails back then, Twitter or anything like that. So you're really working from a very small record. But then, and maybe for that reason, a lot of what he did was kind of embellished by some of his early biographers, in particular Parson Weems, who wrote a very flowery biography of him. It's probably a little more factual than most people give him credit for, but it's, you know, invents dialogue and the like. And it was written, oh, I don't know, in around 1810, something like that.
And I don't think that it was intention to misrepresent. I think it was an intention to give the guy the credit he deserved and tell a nice story at the same time, right?
Yeah, I think that's true, and that's kind of the That was kind of the biographical style back then anyway. But anyway, Parson Weems is the same person who came up with the George Washington and chopping down the cherry tree story. So, and that was...
Which we know isn't true.
Right. His book on Washington and his book on Marion were both extremely popular, and they played a role in sort of giving Americans a national identity, you know, people to look up to. Now, you know, then subsequent biographers kind of took what Weems wrote and, you know, embellished it further, so the myth gets even farther from the actual man.
All right, I want to talk a little bit more about what you discovered in your research, and then I want to go into the slave issue, because that's an incredible issue we got to talk about, too. He did own slaves.
Yep.
But he had a unique behavior towards them, an attitude that is, in my opinion, exemplary. Hold on. John Aller with us. Liberty Roundtable Live.
Kosher. Certified. Put the two words together to get co-certified, which is spelled with an S-E-H instead of just S-H. It's the right way to spell this, the German way, and it made it easier to trademark. Now, did I tell you that the letters S-C-H still make the sh sound, as in all those American food producers saying, shh, let's keep it really quiet that our product is kosher certified? Think about it. Nearly one century of kosher certification, and hardly anyone outside exclusive observers knows that most packaged food and kitchen products are literally certified by religious intermediaries. Well, because you, consumer, are indirectly paying for this, the Kosher Certified app is here to make kosher certification awareness an inclusive matter for people of all faiths and identities. And it even boasts a unique database of products not kosher certified. We call that NKC. Start memeing it. It's fun. NKC. Not kosher certified. Now, to confuse our audience even more, we put a question mark at the end of our name, and that really cinched our trademark approval. It relates to the website where you can begin your new shopping behavior, thekosherquestion.com.
Attention Liberty News Radio listeners. Hard-hitting talk radio has never been and never will be supported by the mainstream in America. Hard-hitting talk radio is taking on the mainstream press like never before. News the networks refuse to use is one of the best ways to educate people. We invite all liberty-loving Americans to join with us to restore the principles of our founding fathers and promote God, family, and country in the media and our lives. Please help spread the liberty message with your generous donation. You can go online at libertynewsradio.com right now and make a donation online. Or call 801-756-9133 and make a donation over the phone. That's libertynewsradio.com and 801-756-9133. Make a donation today. With news the networks refuse to use, you are listening to the Liberty Roundtable Radio Talk Show.
All right, John Aller with us, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about Francis Berry and the Swamp Fox, separating fact from fiction. So in your research, what else did you discover? One was the idea that, hey, things are pretty spread out. The amount of miles these people covered was incredible. What else, sir?
I was a little surprised at the extent to which he was not a politician, but he was elected to the legislature both before and after the war. And while he was not an orator, I think he felt the call to duty to serve in a legislative capacity. He had no major bills attached to his name, but I had always thought that he was, purely a military man. It turns out he did have this political aspect to him, and a lot of that came from his family. His family was probably, his brothers were more political and than he was, but he kind of, you know, went along with that duty.
All right, this is an interesting little statement from your website that I want to highlight here. Not only a new Francis Marion, but a new American Revolution emerges from these riveting pages. Best of all, John Oller has performed this with incredible, impeccable research. It goes on, but the point I'm making is that when you get the true details of Francis Marion, the Revolutionary War takes on new meaning as well, doesn't it?
Yes, and I think more broadly speaking, I was just struck by how significant the war in the South was. Now, you know, most people think Revolutionary War was Bunker Hill and Trenton and, you know, places like that. They don't associate the war with the South. Maybe Yorktown at the very end. Of course, that's not the Deep South. A lot of people don't realize how significant the war in the South was, particularly in that 1780 to 82 period, after war in the North had pretty much achieved a stalemate, and Washington and his British adversaries were kind of watching each other across the river, so to speak. Then the whole theater shifted to the South, and that's really where the war was won, by the American side.
All right, let's talk about his character when it came to slaves. He did inherit and own slaves, mm-hmm. but he had a different attitude than most towards them, right?
Yeah, I think so. He was not what I would call a big plantation owner. He had a small plantation. He might have had, I don't know, there's no exact count, but he might have had 20, 30, maybe as many 50 slaves. And then he had sort of a coterie of domestic slaves, five or six, who were all related to each other, and he was very close with them. He treated them very well. He provided for some of them in his will. That he wrote a will which said that one of his slave girls was to receive an education, which was actually technically illegal in South Carolina at the time. And then another one, a girl, would be provided for until she was age 21, et cetera, et cetera. So he was very generous to them. And he had another sort of a childhood friend who was a slave, named sometimes he goes by Oscar or Buddy. Buddy was his nickname, which he went by most of the time. And he became Marion's, you would call him a valet or manservant, you know, the butler, so to speak. And he was with Marion throughout the entire war. There weren't a huge number of free African Americans in the South, but there were some, and some of them actually served with Marion, as did some Native Americans.
Treated all these men, whether they were white or black or Native American or whatever else, he treated them all with the same respect, didn't he?
Yes. And, I think even after the war, as a legislator, he wanted to provide for freeing some slaves that had helped him during the war. So, you know, that's not to say that he didn't have, you know, the normal prejudices of his time, but I think he was more enlightened than most, and I think he was probably more of a benevolent master than most, although I'm sure he engaged in some disciplinary actions as well, as he had done with his own Continental men, when he was before the war. He could order floggings of his men for various things. All in all, I think he was at the more benign end of the spectrum in terms of slave owners.
We know George Washington was pleased with Francis Marion's work, no doubt about it. Did they have a lot of interaction
No, I don't think they ever met. Washington knew who Marion was. he would receive reports from his generals, Gates and then and Greene. And I think at one time he wrote a letter to one of the, I believe, Greene, and said, you know, General Marion is to be commended on his heroic action at such and such. So Washington, he knew who Marion was, and although they never came in contact with each other, I don't think Francis Marion ever set foot in the North.
All right, I mention this because even though George Washington and Francis Marion couldn't be so different in their circumstances and size and et cetera, they were at the core surprisingly the same in the sense that they were both steady. They were both completely 100% dedicated. They both would trust in some higher source for miracles. They would do their very best and then trust in whatever for the rest. They had a lot of real similar traits, surprisingly enough, right?
Yeah. I think, as I said, Marion has been called the Washington of the South. They were both, had very, as you say, steady is a good word. Some of the generals, leaders of the revolutionary movement were kind of volatile, kind of erratic, you know, up one day, down the next, here, there, everywhere. Washington and Marion were cut from a different cloth.
Not only they were steady, not only did they depend on miracles, they went in not even understanding how it would all come together, but yet they trusted that it would. They were also very unique in that, as far as I can tell, both men, it wasn't about them. They were in it all the way for the real cause and never equivocated, never capitulated, never backed away from that. Even when he threatened to resign under Greene, once they kind of aired out their grievances, he never talked about it again. So I don't know if it was really that he wanted to resign and give up, or if it was more of a kind of like, I'm not going to take this stuff, you better back down discussion. But they never really wavered from the cause being greater than themselves, and they were never interested really in the credit per se, right? Either of them.
Right. He was, as I say, a team player in a way that not everyone was.
All right. Any disappointing things about him? Because I've studied the guy, too, and I don't know. I don't find a lot.
You know, I think I said at the end of the book that most historical figures who are highly regarded and venerated, the more you study them, the less you like them, the more you discover their flaws, and they kind of come down in your eyes. They have feet of clay, so to speak. But Marion is different in that I think the more you study him, the more admirable he becomes, and the more things you discover about him that just leave you kind of scratching your head as to how such person could have existed. I don't think he had any major flaws. He could be a little thin-skinned at times, but he always got over it.
But his thick skin, too, is what carried him through, though. I mean, when people would shut him down as a leader, he would humbly accept the order that the army trained him to accept. And maybe he was thin-skinned a little bit, but, I mean, he had tremendous ability to humble himself, too, when necessary, right?
Yeah. I think at times he felt a little underappreciated because he was not getting men and material from the North. You know, Congress was bankrupt, so there really was no support, no operational support for his group, and he was going it alone for a time. And you know, anyone could let that situation get them down at least temporarily.
When we come back, I want to talk about the modern day support that you've had in your research that other authors have not had the blessings of. I think this helps you really put together the separation of the myth, the man, and the legend kind of thing to separate truth and error and really focus on the truth about Francis Marion. We'll do that in seconds with John Oller on your radio.
Exposing corruption. Informing citizens. Pursuing liberty. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
U.S. USA Radio News with Wendy King.
The state's first-in-the-nation primaries in New Hampshire is leaning towards Senator Bernie Sanders. Pete Buttigieg is close behind.
Thanks to you, a campaign that some said shouldn't be here at all has shown that we are here to stay.
Behind Mayor Pete, Senator Amy Klobuchar.
The people of New Hampshire, because of you, we are taking this campaign to Nevada.
Klobuchar's campaign is planning to expand staff in Nevada, South Carolina, and other Super Tuesday states. Despite trailing, Senator Elizabeth Warren's campaign is still hanging on.
If we have the courage to fight hard, we are going to win.
Senator Michael Bennett and entrepreneur Andrew Yang have announced they're dropping out of the race. And Deval Patrick plans to suspend his campaign on Wednesday. This is USA Radio News.
Here is some great news. If you missed the deadline to sign up for health insurance, or if you sign up for a plan that you're just not happy with, you still have a choice. It's called MediShare. It's the affordable alternative to health insurance. And it's worked beautifully for 25 years. They have more than 400,000 members now around the country. MediShare is a Christian healthcare sharing ministry. And over the years, members have shared over $3 billion of each other's medical bills. So they could help share your needs too. And best of all, you could save a lot of money with MediShare. The typical savings for a family is about $500 a month. Your savings could be more or less, but think about what you could do with that extra money every month. You're not stuck with a high-cost health plan. You can join MediShare anytime, so call them today and check it out. Here's the number to find out more, and there's no pressure. They are super easy to talk to. Call 833-34-BIBLE. That's 833-34-BIBLE. 833-34-BIBLE.
Harvey Weinstein supposedly wanted to testify at his rape and sex assault trial in New York City, but his lawyers said no to that. Now the disgraced movie mogul's defense team has rested its case. It's preparing closing arguments expected tomorrow. Weinstein's lawyers took just 3 days to call witnesses in an effort to raise doubts about his accuser's claims. Virginia lawmakers have approved a bill that would give local governments the power to remove Confederate monuments. The bill allows for cities and counties to alter, cover, remove, relocate, or contextualize the monuments in their public spaces. Over 200 breeds competed at the 144th annual Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show, but a standard poodle named Siba took home best in show. Her handler, Paul Kloss, says,
"This is her final show. She's been out for 2 years, campaigning up and down the coast, out into the middle of the country."
A Whippet placed second, and this is USA Radio News.
Ladies and gentlemen, John Oller, author, journalist, and more, historian, if you will. His research and his attention to detail is impeccable. You want to learn more? John Oller, JohnOllernyc.com is his website. You can get this incredible book in many forms. Okay, it's the admiring biography of Francis Marion, the Swamp Fox. It's called The Swamp Fox, How Francis Marion Saved the American Revolution. It's available just about anywhere, but you can get it on Audible. You can get it hardback, paperback. I mean, it's everywhere. Came out in 2016. It's really, in my mind, the definitive, best work we've seen to date by far on Francis Marion. And I study this guy, folks. I don't know if you can tell through the interview, but I don't know a lot. I know quite a bit. Compared to a John, I know nothing, but nevertheless, you've had modern capabilities and techniques and time on your side in terms of research that others haven't really had. That allows you to separate the fact from fiction quite well, doesn't it?
Yeah, a couple things that I had the benefit of that maybe some prior biographies did not. One was archaeological studies. There's been a lot of work done in the last 15 years, let's say, of people going to the battle sites, you know, finding, unearthing the bullets and et cetera that show exactly, you know, where men were positioned and where the shooting took place. And it's allowed, for the correction of a lot of, misconceptions of how some of these engagements, went down. Another very valuable source were pension records. Now, there have always been these pension records, but they were hard copy and, you know, stowed away in the National Archives in Washington. So someone would have to actually go there. But now they've been digitized and they're word searchable so that you can, you know, plug in Francis Marion into pension records. And when I say pension records, these are basically affidavits made out by veterans of the war, you know, in some cases many years after the war, laying out their record of service so that it would entitle them to a pension from Congress. But they would describe what battles they were in and who they served under and, in some cases, how the battles went. And they're not always 100% reliable, but they are they're a very valuable resource.
But in their totality, they really speak to his character, which we haven't had before.
Yes, and you know, if you get several pensioners saying kind of the same thing, then you can sort of trust it. And they all spoke very highly of Marion in their pension statements. So that was another thing. And then there's just been a lot of interest in the Southern Theater of the War in the last 10, 15 years, magazines devoted to it, and articles, research, and I was able to just kind of, to some extent, bring all that together, the learning of the past 10, 20 years, and use it to inform my biography of Marion.
You know, ladies and gentlemen, in modern day, they've really spent a lot of time researching what makes incredible leaders and team players. And they've come down with three kind of main things that you got to have. You got to be humble, you got to be hungry, and you got to be smart. And humble means, humble doesn't mean you always give in and you're just docile and you never challenge things. To ignore something that's critical that you need to stand up for is a betrayal of humility. So humble is a unique position that Francis Marion really walked the line of to a T, almost better than anybody I've ever researched or known. The hungry part has to do with, you know, hey, you don't walk over people to get to the top. That's not hungry. That's an abuse of the principle of hungry. Hungry means that you're absolutely, unequivocally dedicated to your cause and willing to get after it day to day. It's the motivational hunger we're talking about. And then smart has to do with people smarts. It's being cognizant of your actions and your speeches and your efforts to where you look around you and you understand and can gauge how it's how others are responding to your influence, etc. So we're talking about people smarts, if you will. Francis Marion was top notch in all three, sir.
Yes, and on the smarts element, you know, he was not a highly educated man. He was had a, you know, sort of a common education, if at best. He might have been tutored a little bit also, but you know, he certainly never attended a university. He was not like the
he wasn't the Ivy Leagues of his contemporaries, if you will.
No, and nor was he even in the league of, I would call them, the Charleston aristocrats. So, you know, the Pinckneys, the some of those people who were really, I would call them, you know, the firebrands of the Revolution in the South. Lawrence and some of those people, they were, you know, they were orators, they were agitators, and you needed them to stir up people. But that wasn't Marion. He was, as I say, he was not really a aristocrat from Charleston, but he also wasn't some country bumpkin from the backwoods who was illiterate. So he had enough education that he could write out military orders and the like, and I think he was articulate and eloquent in his own way.
Although he may not have been super educated, he was pretty much middle class and middle education of the time, that doesn't take anything away from his brilliant intelligence, though. I mean, this guy was a strategist like no other.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know where that comes from. It was sort of intuitive to him. Now, part of it was learned. He learned a lot of the guerrilla tactics during the French and Indian War when he was fighting with the British against the Cherokees in western South Carolina. So he learned kind of those ambush hit and run tactics. He saw them used by the Native Americans. So he dipped into that reservoir of knowledge when it came time to conduct his own partisan guerrilla campaign. But a lot of it, I think, was just intuitive and, you know, sort of a genius. That, you know, how do you explain genius?
And that's what we find oftentimes. People that are a little bit misfit in society, they're not bad people. They just don't, you know, garner the day-to-day interactions that most of us normally do, etc. It's almost like those people have these uncanny abilities to fulfill whatever role they find themselves in. In modern days, it might be somebody who's great at computers, or but they seem to find some way to be uncommon in their time, right?
Thomas Edison was a dunce in school, but you know, one of the greatest inventors of all time. Abraham Lincoln had no, you know, formal education, but there was something in him that made him rise above his modest circumstances. And I think Marion is, you know, along those same lines.
And I think it's that uncanny humility that I'm talking about. Humility doesn't mean you always just cave and you walk around like a mouse and you're docile. Humility is knowing when to give in, when to stand up, when to think enough of yourself, have enough integrity in your own character and to know who you are. I don't know if it's before God or before society, but yet not become too far thinking that you're somehow the cat's meow. There's this balance in humility that it takes that every one of these people that I study have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Did anything in your studies disappoint you, where you're like, you know what, I thought it was different, or I thought it was better than that, or anything? As you study the guys, is there anything that disappointed you?
No, I wouldn't say disappointed. It was more just kind of surprised, maybe, at just how small and short some of these engagements were that carry, you know, major names today, at least among Revolutionary War researchers. You know, Black Mingo, Blue Savannah, some of those places. You know, these were sometimes battles between 20 guys on one side and 30 guys on the other side, and yeah, they might have lasted 10 minutes. The casualties would be, you know, two men killed and four wounded on each side, roughly. I mean, very small engagements.
Well, you make a point that maybe the war or the battle wins in those cases weren't really the significant piece. It was the terror that he instilled in the British, and it was the overall strategic difference that it made that mattered more than even the quote the battle itself. I mean, that's a point you made in the book, right?
Yeah, and you know, not to get too modern about things, but you know, the British at the time, they did consider Francis Marion to be basically a terrorist. You know, the way that we would think of you know, Mideast terrorists, In another sense, he was kind of in the same position, and the British were sort of in the same position that the Americans were in Vietnam, and the Vietnamese, you know, fighting on their home turf, greatly outnumbered and, you know, to the greatest military power in the world, you know, prevailed. And so there's some analogies there.
John Aller with us, ladies and gentlemen. Hang tight. Final segment in seconds on your radio.
As the United States boldly stepped forward in the glorious light provided by its new Constitution in 1787, the nations of the earth were in awe of the newfound strength and hope of this free land. Today, the nation stands at a crossroads. A divergence from the original intent put forth in the United States Constitution has brought grave threats to our beloved nation. A miracle is needed if the United States is to survive. That miracle is, again, the pure application of the United States Constitution. I'm Scott Bradley. In my To Preserve the Nation book and lecture series, I bring forth truths that will help raise up a new generation of statesmen like those noble Americans who founded this land. Vigorous application of these principles will invigorate and restore the nation, and we may become again the freest, most prosperous, most respected, and happiest nation on earth. Visit topreservethenation.com to begin that restoration.
Okay, girls, about finished with your lesson on money?
Daddy, what is a buy-sell spread for gold coins?
Well, when you sell a gold coin to a coin shop that's worth, say, $1,200, you don't actually get $1,200. But don't worry, we're members of UPMA now, so we don't have to worry about that.
Daddy, what if somebody steals our gold?
We don't have any gold at the house. It's stored safely in the UPMA vault, securely and insured.
But the S&P 500 outperformed gold. Daddy, gold is a bad investment.
Some people do think of it that way, but actually, gold is money. And as members of the United Precious Metals Association, we can use our gold at any store, just like a credit card. Or I can ask them to drop it right into Mommy and Daddy's bank account, because we're a UPMA member family.
Find out more at upma.org. That's upma.org.
We're talking about the American Revolution, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about heroes in that sacred cause fighting for liberty. Francis Marion is certainly one of them, to say the least. John Oller, author and our guest. His book, The Swamp Fox, How Francis Marion Saved the American Revolution. John Oller, NYC.com, if you want to go to his website and check it out. He's got a lot of other books that are nonfiction as well on incredible topics. And I'm hoping he'll write another book. Anyway, time will tell on that. But I bring this up to say these unique situations in the South, I don't know that we've ever... what happens is, because of the Civil War, you're either a North guy or a South guy, and there's almost no reality in between. When you study this, though, you say it wasn't about a battle between the North and the South. It was almost two separate wars in a way. But yet the South saved the North. Really, John?
Yeah, it's, you had a civil war within the South, Tory versus Patriot, and then you had a stalemate, in essence, in the North. Just to back up, the British strategy, which was known as the Southern Strategy, was, after things stalemated in the North, they figured, well, we'll go down South, to South Carolina, Georgia, and we'll tap into the reservoir of goodwill from the Loyalists or Tories down there and use that to overcome the Patriots, and then we will work our way north up through the through North Carolina, then Virginia, and since the British were stationed in and controlled New York City during the entire Revolution, basically, they would come down and serve a pincer movement from the north and then up from the south and trap George Washington, who was hanging out in New Jersey, trap him in between and end the war. That was the Southern strategy. That was the theory. It didn't end up working out because the Tories in the South were, frankly, didn't have the kind of leadership that Marion and a couple other militia leaders brought to the table. And they didn't have the burning desire. They were loyal to Britain, but they didn't have any overriding ideological or philosophical cause they were fighting for. So, with the help, great help of Marion, the South held up at a critical juncture, was not overrun by the British, turned the tables on the British when Nathanael Greene came south. Nathanael Greene was, Washington's favorite general. He was his right-hand man. He sent Greene down to south to command down there. Greene enlisted Marion as his, eyes and ears. And sort of together, they drove the British out of South Carolina, drove them back to the to Charleston, and in time, if Yorktown hadn't happened, probably something like it would have happened in Charleston. With the French may have come with their fleet to Charleston, and war ended there. But So yeah, it was. I mean, I don't think it's North or South. It was a joint effort. Obviously, Washington held things together in the North. There were many, many times when, if Washington hadn't done what he did in the North, the war would have been over then. So there were many, many critical junctures where, if things had gone the other way, the British would have prevailed. So
I bring it up because it really is the United States.
Yeah, and I think that at least at that time, there was not this great enmity between North and South that developed, later in the mid 1800s.
All right, Francis Marion. Like I say, I just can't underestimate the brilliance of the man here. The guy was brilliant in many ways, and the reason I say that is, he made some mistakes, and you highlight a couple of them in the book, but there's not very many mistakes the guy made. He knew when to attack. He knew when to hold back. He wasn't, like others, willing just to go it alone in a stupid fashion, but he went it alone by necessity a lot of the time. But he was brilliant in deciding when he had the advantage. His ability to assess the odds was incredible.
Yeah, I think he was in about two dozen engagements, from minor skirmishes to more substantial engagements in that two-year period, 1780 to 1782, and he won all but one of them, or a couple draws, I would say. But he only lost, out and out lost, once out of those two dozen, and it was at the very end of the war, and it was kind of an inconsequential battle, and he was victimized by a deputy who kind of screwed things up. So he had a very high batting average in terms of wins, much higher batting average than, say, Thomas Sumter.
Almost more so than anybody in the war. Really?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that you can find another general that had more wins and more calculated risks that turned out favorable.
I think that's true. I mean, even the great Nathanael Greene never actually won a battle. He had tactical losses, but he sort of, they were strategic, long-term strategic wins because he, survived to fight another day. But, I don't know of anyone who had a higher percentage of victories in his engagements than in the Revolution than Marion did.
As you can tell, I've read the book and I understand a lot of it, and I've studied this guy for years. He's one of my favorite characters that are larger than life. I want to be like the guy. I've driven a lot of the questions to get where we are. What have I left out that people need to know?
Oh, I think there were a couple very interesting sieges that Marion conducted together with Light Horse Harry Lee. They were forts, Fort Watson and Fort Mott, and both of those engagements deserve a lot more study, I think. They were true turning points in the Southern theater where the Americans recaptured two outposts that the British had set up after they conquered Charleston.
And this is the brilliance and the humility of Marion again in Fort Watt. It was, I guess, one of his soldiers came up with the idea that changed the game. And he, instead of being like, I'm the man and I know, he's like, you know what? Why don't you try it? Kind of an idea. That's uncharacteristic too, right?
That was at Fort Watson, where they built a sort of a tower. He had a guy named Mahon, and it became known as the Mahon Tower. It didn't become known as the Marion Tower, even though Marion was in command. He allowed Mahon to take credit, deservedly so, for the most part. But they built this tower up so that they could climb to the top and put a couple sharpshooters up there to shoot down into the fort. And once that started, the British, it was a log tower, basically. The British, had to surrender. In another case, Fort Mott, what they did was they burned the fort by shooting an arrow, a fire arrow, on top of the roof, setting it afire, and the British then... You
know, and they said they would never give up until the fireball hit the roof, and they actually saved the whole thing, right?
The structure, yeah, yeah. So, you know, that's an example of he used whatever tactic he needed to at the time. You know,
but he also acquiesced to other men's ideas. There's a lot of men that wouldn't do that either.
That's right. He was persuadable. You know, he had his views, and he and Harry Lee had some differences of opinion, and he and Green had some differences of opinion from time to time on the best strategy. You know, which place do we attack next? Where do we defend next? And Marion had his views, and he stated them. But if he was persuaded by the other guy, then he went along with it, and he didn't, you know, he also was not one of these Monday morning quarterbacks where if something went wrong, he, you know, I told you so, or stuff like that. So
he also wasn't one to agree to do something but withhold his support. In other words, once he agreed, you could count on him.
That's right. That's right.
Which I think is really important and legendary, too, because a lot of guys would say, fine, you win, but they'd kind of fight it and have this grumble murmur attitude the whole time. He wasn't like that.
Right. He was all in once he, you know, decided to enter the fray. So, you know, I think we've covered about everything.
Yeah. All right. I appreciate it, sir. We thank you so much for your hard work and for your diligence and attention to detail. I think we're learning about the man, and I think his real attributes are much better than even the Rambo articulation or portrayal of him. His real character was something to behold.
Yeah. Okay, well...
Thank you, John.
Talking. Look out for my next books.
We'll do it, sir. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
There he goes. Kurt, you want a final comment on this interview? I know it's long. I know it took 2 hours, but I'm telling you, if you want to learn about history, you read Prelude to Glory, a 9-volume series about the Revolutionary War, and then you read this book about Francis Marion, the Swamp Fox, and I'm telling you right now, you will gain an understanding of and respect for history like you wouldn't believe. The very few changed the game. They were humble, they were hungry, they were people smart, and there was a few characters that really carried the day, I believe, under the orchestration of Almighty God. Now, that's my opinion, to which I'm entitled. I share that opinion with the Founding Fathers. Anyway, you got a final parting shot, Kurt?
Well, one of the things I will say is that, it's so important, ladies and gentlemen, that we, that we know about the heroes and that we can, I guess you could say, try to emulate them. In our society, so much of our society focuses on the negative and on the, so-called heroes that really aren't worthy of emulation. They're not the type that we need to lead out, and our standard media always wants to take down the real heroes simply because that makes us less of a society, and so there's, you know, that continual battle between good and evil. That's why we bring this story to you, to make sure that you're aware of, you know, great people in the past, and then you wonder why, maybe if you're living in that area, why there's so many Francis Marions or, you know, that kind of thing. Maybe you can understand it a little better and hope that these names and these leaders and these good individuals from the past can give us all, I guess you could say, the courage to do the best we can today as we manipulate the swamp.
Amen. And the most important takeaway, in my opinion, was one: we want to emulate these people. They're just men. We don't worship them, but we do certainly want to learn from their attributes that made them beyond good. It made them great. And
maybe I should have said navigate the swamp.
Amen to that. Yes, sir. And I will say this. One thing we really want to know is, you know what? Tales of heroism that aren't factual aren't near as valuable as the truth about these people. When you learn the truth about George Washington, Francis Marion, John Glover, some of these key players, man, I'm telling you, it's more impressive than even the Rambo stuff, because you just begin to understand that it's about God, family, and country. And that's what we're all about in modern day. And we hope to emulate their example as we defend the greatest country on the face of the earth. LibertyRoundtable.com. God save the Republic of the United States of America.